This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to www.bbc.co.uk/radio3.
Sometime in the 940s, a Dorset woman called Winfled sat down with her local priest and drew up her will, dividing her scattered possessions between her children and grandchildren, her friends and servants. It's the first woman's will in British history, a document that for the first time opens a window on the life of an Anglo-Saxon woman below the ranks of royalty. Winfled, her name means bright beauty, was a widow with grown-up children. But women married young in those days, and life expectancy was much shorter than ours, and she was maybe still only in her 40s. She'd grown up in the bleak winters of the 910s, when big freezes and bad harvests were made more miserable by Viking raids. She'd married perhaps in the electric time when the Kingdom of England was created in the 920s, and I suppose it's possible that her husband had died fighting in the campaigns in the north in the 930s or 40s. The Viking Age, one suspects, was a bit like World War I. Many men died in war, and left many unmarried women and widows. And maybe that's why we find so many single women then playing a role in religious and cultural life. More than a dozen grants survive from this time in which kings gift land to provide religious women with property and income, living not in nunneries, but in their own households, where they followed a religious life, perhaps after a vow of chastity. That's how I imagine Winfled. Her will tells us she had a grown-up son, Eadmer, who was married with two children. Her daughter, Athelflaed, is unmarried and clearly close to her mother. It's possible Winfled had other children, but only these two were still alive. So let's look at her will. Women's history has been erased in every period, of course, but here you can get a glimpse of one Anglo-Saxon woman's life, her relationships, her possessions, and even perhaps her values. Her words would have been taken down by the scribe, maybe her own family priest, and if we turn them into direct speech, we can hear what she actually spoke and imagine her listing the inventory of her clothes and jewels, her animals and her slaves. She starts off with what was most on her mind as a devout Christian, the fate of her soul. But she's also bothered about her role in the community of women to which she's attached, members of the small nunnery founded by Alfred the Great at Shaftesbury. She begins with this: "I, Winfled, declare how I wish to dispose of my goods after my death. I bequeath to the church my vestments and the best of my offering cloths and my cross, and to the refectory 2 silver cups for the community. And as a gift for the good of my soul, a gold coin to every servant of God there, and 1 more gold coin to Ceolthryth and Elsa and Athelswith. And I grant to Ceolthryth whichever she prefers of my black tunics and my best holy veil and my best headband." Winfled's relations with women were clearly very important to her. Many of her gifts are to women friends, like these religious clothes. Winfled, it turns out, had a sizable wardrobe, and it may be that the seamstresses and weavers on her estate helped provide clothes for the women in the community which she supported as a wealthy widow. There's no suggestion, by the way, that Winfled felt uncomfortable with fine clothes and possessions. Her contemporaries were divided over these things. There were churchmen who castigated women who wore rich clothes and fancy jewels. But others disagreed. One Wilton nun defended herself against a male accuser, simply pointing out that pride can lurk just as surely under a hair shirt. Now Winfled comes to her daughter. "I bequeath to my daughter Athelflaed my engraved bracelet and my brooch, and the farm at Ebsbourne with the title deed as a perpetual inheritance, and I grant the men and the livestock on the land there too." Winflad's mention of her engraved bracelet and her best brooch takes us into the world of well-to-do Anglo-Saxon women. They loved ornaments and jewels, especially with fine inlay and filigree work. Perhaps these were heirlooms from her own mother, Brightwin, one of several religious-minded women who'd been supported by the late King Athelstan. The estate at Ebsbourne was perhaps special to them, maybe the family house where Winflad had brought up her children. And anyone who's been to Ebsbourne Wake in the Chalk Valley today, with its soft combes rising above the roofs of the medieval and Tudor farmsteads, will be able to imagine it. Next come her friends, and here we get a further sense of the material life of an Anglo-Saxon woman's household. I bequeath to Athelfled, Ealhelm's daughter, my double badger-skin gown, and a linen one, and to Eadgifu two chests, and in them my best bed curtain, and a linen coverlet, and all the bedclothes that go with it, and my dun tunic, my best cloak, my two wooden cups decorated with dots, and my old filigree brooch worth 6 mancuses. Now that was a generous gift. A mancus was a gold coin worth a month's wages for a skilled worker. So it was a beautiful piece, which maybe had sentimental value. Winflad also gives her friends her spinning box and her long-haul tapestry. Weaving and embroidery were English arts, and the work of Anglo-Saxon needlewomen was prized abroad as opus Anglicanum, English work. Woven and embroidered tapestries depicting heroic or biblical scenes were often hung on the walls of Anglo-Saxon wooden halls, to provide richly coloured decoration and also to act as draught-proofing when the winds whistled through the gaps in the plaster. And again, such a piece might have been a fine heirloom. Now, of course, like all traditional societies, and indeed still to an extent our own today, Anglo-Saxon England was gender-divided and patriarchal. But Winflad, by the standards of her day, was an autonomous woman and was able to dispose of her property as she wished. Her household was run as she decreed, and she could bequeath her property with no influence or pressure from her late husband's family. In Anglo-Saxon England, this was true for free women, who after a divorce could even hold on to their own property. These rights were gradually eroded after the Norman conquest, and some only restored by the Married Women's Property Act of 1870. Winflad, one guesses, lived an active life. She mentions her horses and her red tent, and with estates spread between Shaftesbury and the coast and outliers as far away as Oxfordshire, she might well have spent quite a bit of time in the saddle, going round her estates, conferring with her stewards at seed time and harvest. She had agricultural workers, weavers, needlewomen and slaves. Slavery was a fact of life in the 10th century, although in her will, Winflad was moved to give more than 30 people their freedom for the salvation of her own soul, a frequent custom of the time. And among her slaves, incidentally, she mentions Alfseger the cook. As often today in traditional societies, the cooks were men. She's typical, then, of a particular class of Anglo-Saxon religious women who emerge in the early 10th century. One charming story from Somerset in the 930s tells of King Athelstan visiting the private house of a noblewoman, a widow like Winflad. She's pictured anxiously planning the food and drink for the royal visit, fretting whether her supply of mead will last given the drinking habits of the king's thanes. And then, as the woman of the house, supervising the rituals of the meal, offering the first cup to the king, along with pleasing conversation. That, the poet said, was the role of the woman in the hall. And Winflad no doubt knew such moments. She bequeaths fine drinking horns and her gold-adorned wooden cup. Winflad mentions many place names which make up her mental map of her corner of Dorset, the lovely valleys south of Shaftesbury, like the Winterbournes, where more isolated villages are still joined by unmade-up lanes, mud-streaked farm tracks between towering ancient hedgerows. Her daughter, Athelfled, also lived in this corner of Dorset, and she's the subject of the final lines of the will. I grant to Athelflad the storage chest and the utensils and all the useful things that are in it, and also the homestead itself, if the king granted to her, just as the late King Edward granted it to my mother Brightwin. And then there's this last legacy to her daughter. I give Æthelflæd everything else not mentioned here, including the books and other such small items, and I trust she will be mindful of my soul. What she means is that she expects her daughter will continue to pray for her soul after her death. This anxious tone we find in many bequests and book inscriptions at this time. It was an age weighed down by a sense of sin, and sin not as a single act, but as the condition of human existence itself. But what's especially interesting is the mention of books. What did Winflad and her daughter read? Well, she would certainly have had a psalter. The psalms were favourite texts for daily reading and consolation. She would have learned her Latin with the psalter. She may have had a missal too, but perhaps she also had poetry. In a noble house, then, you might hear, for example, the tearful passion of Boethius, recited out loud by Singer in Alfred the Great's verse translation. There were poems about women, like Judith, which told the tale of the biblical heroine. And there was love poetry. Our view of the Anglo-Saxons as people tends to be dominated by religious texts, and it's easy to forget they were full-blooded people who loved poetry and song, feasting and society. Winflad herself had known the love of husband, children and family, and there's no reason why she shouldn't have enjoyed poems about love. As Chaucer says, they may have lived 1,000 years ago, but they sped as well in love as we do now. I'm imagining now, I admit, to try to give warmth to her life. Women's lives then, as for so long afterwards, are hard to touch. But the picture of local Dorset society that emerges from her will, one might almost call a forerunner of the English country gentry. We're apt to see the Norman Conquest as a great break in our social history. In some ways it was, but there were many continuities in material culture and mental horizons. And back in the mid-10th century, Winflad was clearly not living in a wattle and daub farm with cows across the passage. She had a hall with tapestries, matching bed linen and fine tableware. She had stables and bred horses. She had the wherewithal in the kitchen for the midsummer feast when they lit bonfires and when Alf Seeger the cook produced the communal meal for the workers. At home there were visits from the local abbot or abbess when wine flowed and stories were told. Then she was the host, pouring the wine, performing the social rituals of the hall, and giving advice, as the Beowulf poet says. Such women had culture, books, contacts with the court. By the end of the century, the famous teacher and writer Abbot Elfrich of Aynsham corresponded with local thanes, who asked him for translations in the vernacular, versions of biblical texts and saints' lives to be read in their hall to family and friends. And no doubt their wives, mothers and kinswomen, like Winflad, shared in these interests. So Winflad's will, it seems to me, gives us a precious flash of intimacy into a woman's life in the Viking Age. Does this all sound distantly familiar? Well, it seems to me, if you don't think this is too fanciful, that Winflad is the ancestor of medieval women like the Pastons in the 1400s, who write so movingly about their inner lives as women. Or the Tudor farming women with their chapbooks who come to life in 16th century wills. Or for that matter, how about Olivia in Twelfth Night? Or Jane Austen's Country Widows? Winflad, to me, is a recognisable English countrywoman, capable, fair-minded, strongly aware of class and status, but with a sense of obligation to the less well-off. Pious and practical, she lived through great times. Now, if only we had her letters.